Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for April 12, 2016. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Mikael Garcia Marcos about how mutations in a G protein cause auriculocondylar syndrome. Auriculocondylar syndrome, or ACS, is a rare genetic condition that affects craniofacial development, most notably the ears and the lower jaw. Both of these tissues are formed by neural crest cells during embryonic development. The syndrome is caused by mutations in the signaling pathway downstream of the endothelin type A receptor. This receptor is a G protein-coupled receptor, so its activation at the cell surface triggers activation of intracellular heterotrimeric G proteins. This ultimately induces the expression of genes encoding transcription factors that direct the proper development of these neural crest cells. A group led by Mikael Garcia Marcos has found that mutations in G-alpha-I3 that are associated with auriculocondylar syndrome cause the endothelin type A receptor to couple to the wrong G protein, which leads to termination of signaling. Garcia Marcos spoke to me from Boston University. Hi, Dr. Garcia Marcos. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Hi, thank you.
What are the symptoms that characterize auriculocondylar syndrome, and what's known about the molecular causes of the disease?
This syndrome, we normally call it ACS in short, is characterized by facial malformations that predominantly happen in the lower half of the face, including the ears and the jaw. And the features of the patients are very heterogeneous. Some of them are really mild, and they have a condition that is called question mark ears, and as its name indicates, it just affects the shape of the ear. But in other cases, it can be life-threatening in the sense that the patients need surgery to be able to breathe normally. So what is known about this disease is that it manifests at birth, and it's known to be caused by developmental defects during embryogenesis. What it happens is that neural crest cells do not differentiate properly into the tissues that will become part of the face. And at the molecular level, this is caused by defects in the signal transduction mechanism triggered by the peptide endothelin that acts on a receptor called the endothelin type A receptor that triggers a cascade of signaling events that eventually activate two transcription factors called DLX5 and DLX6, which are the ones responsible for differentiating the neural crest cells that will become eventually the tissues that form the lower half of your face.
The endothelin type A receptor, like other GPCRs, signals through heterotrimeric G proteins, which are composed of alpha, beta, and gamma subunits. When the G proteins are activated, the complex breaks apart so that the alpha subunit is released, and it transduces signaling independently of the beta and gamma subunits. There are lots of alpha subunits. Which ones are involved in signaling downstream of the endothelin type A receptor?
Yes, it's important to know a little bit about the different G alpha subunits and that they are broadly classified into different families depending on their intracellular targets. And what is known is that the endothelin receptor works predominantly, and I would like to emphasize the word predominantly, by acting on G-alpha subunits of the what is called the GQ/11 family, which are known to activate phospholipase C. And the reason why I think it's important to emphasize that predominantly works on GQ11 is that it's known that to some extent can couple to other types of G proteins, but they are activated less efficiently by this receptor.
Some patients with ACS have mutations in the G protein G-alpha-I3. How does the activity of G-alpha-I3 differ from that of G-alpha-Q11?
Yes, so this is what was intriguing to us in the beginning, because G-alpha-I3 regulates adrenal cyclase and cyclic AMP levels, but not PLC, like G-alpha-Q does. And this did not fit very well with the overall picture on this disease, because the clues available to date were suggesting that the G proteins involved in this syndrome in ACS would likely belong to the GQ11 family. So, for example, some patients who don't have mutations on G proteins but have this disease have mutations in PLC, which, as I said before, is a target for the GQ11 but not GLPI3. So it was somewhat surprising that the patients had mutations in GLPI3 instead of one of the members of the GLPIQ family.
And so in this study, you looked at the effects of mutations in GLPI3 on craniofacial development in frog embryos. What happened when you put mutations in GLPI3 that are associated with ACS in humans into frog embryos?
What we found is that the developmental defects were more severe when we introduced the disease-associated mutants compared to the wild-type protein. And this was the first indication that the mutants did not simply cause a loss of function in GLPI3, but that they had some sort of dominant effect.
So when you put the wild-type human GLPI3 into frog embryos, you get some craniofacial defects. But when you put forms of the human GLPI3 that carry mutations that are associated with ACS into the frog embryos, then you get much more severe craniofacial defects?
Yes, that is correct. So the developmental defects appear to a very low extent when you express the wild-type protein, but when you introduce the mutants, this is dramatically enhanced.
How do those mutations in GLPI3 perturb the signaling downstream of the endothelin type A receptor?
So here is where we think the novelty of the work is. GLPI3 mutants block signaling, we call it horizontally, meaning that they prevent the activation of another G protein, which is GLPIQ, by the endothelin receptor. What we found is that GLPI3 mutants bind to the endothelin receptor and remain locked in an inactive conformation. Because they don't become active, they remain associated with that receptor and work as, you could consider them as a plaque, as a molecular plaque that prevents the physical association of GLPIQ with the endothelin receptor and the subsequent activation.
These mutant forms of GLPI3 bind to the endothelin type A receptor. Does the normal form of GLPI3 also bind to the endothelin type A receptor, and these mutant forms just bind better?
Yes. So what happens is normally GLPI3 wild type could bind to the endothelin receptor, but in the case of the disease mutants, we found that they bind with higher affinity and that also that probably they remain bound to the receptor, so it becomes also an irreversible interaction, and that is what prevents the recruitment of other G proteins like GLPIQ and their activation.
Why do you think that there haven't been any mutations in GLPIQ11 reported in ACS patients?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I don't really know, but one could imagine some possible explanations. One is that mutations in GQ and or G11 would cause defects beyond the differentiation of neural crest cells. So even if they existed, they would likely cause a different disease, not just ACS. And another possible explanation is that could be related to that redundancy among GQ type G proteins. So the GQ family is composed of four alpha subunits, and all of them can potentially work in this pathway that links the endothelin receptor to phospholipase C, to PLC. So mutations in a single gene, in a single GLPIQ gene, might not be sufficient to give a phenotype. And in this regard, maybe it makes sense to have another unrelated G protein like GLPI3 work as a dominant negative and block simultaneously the activation of any protein of the GQ family.
These mutations in GLPI3 that are associated with ACS are essentially behaving as dominant negatives. Are there any other dominant negative mutations in G protein subunits that we know of that cause disease? I mean, is this a common disease mechanism?
No, this is actually something unique. What we know, have known for decades, is that there are mutations in G proteins that can cause human disease, but none of those mutations behave as dominant negatives. They either cause a gain of function or a loss of function of the protein, but not a dominant negative effect. So this is a first.
Mikhail, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Mikhail Garcia-Marcos discussing a paper published in the April 12th issue of Science Signaling by Marovin and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.